Hey, everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. This is a really important episode because it is not that often that you run into and meet a founder and are introduced to a company that has had, for me, such a big, huge material impact on my health. And this is one of those things that it's not just subjective feeling, but it's actually measurable in my blood work and in my day-to-day life, in monitoring my glucose levels. So I'm excited to tell you all about this crazy probiotic. But one of the things that was tricky for me in recording this episode is how I present this information to you, because I didn't want it to come off sounding like an ad. And the tricky part is that I'm a partner, of course, over at True Ventures. Most of you know that. And we invested in this company. That's how I actually was introduced to the company and how I first heard about it. The company did not ask me to record the podcast, nor are they paying for me to do this in any form, including through their product. I actually buy the product directly, personally, on my own credit card through their website. I'm not reimbursed for it. So there is no exchange of money in any way. If you follow my newsletter or my podcast over the years, you'll know that this is something I take really seriously. I don't do pay for play. It's just not in my DNA. It's not worth the money or the reputation damage. So, but this is a real story of something that happened to me. And I guess that's the best place to start off is with the story itself. And that is that I first was introduced to Dr. Peter Attia. You may know the Peter Attia Drive, his podcast. He's been a guest on Joe Rogan and Tim Ferriss, a really well-known doctor that specializes in longevity and prevention of disease. And so Attia brought me on as a patient, I guess about 4 or so years ago. We started off by doing a really deep dive into my blood work and doing a slew of different tests, including what's called a glucose tolerance test. And that is where you drink this really sugary drink. It's 100% glucose, and you have your blood drawn before you do the drink. So in a fasting state. And then it's also drawn every, I think, 20 or 30 minutes for about an hour and a half. And essentially what you're doing is you're saying, okay, if I introduce straight up sugar glucose into my body, how high does my blood sugar spike? And then how quickly does my body get rid of that? So how quickly is insulin introduced? And then how efficient is my body at disposing of that glucose? So did all the tests, all the onboarding with Peter Attia. And one of the things that we found very early on in our relationship working together is that I am borderline pre-diabetic. So my glucose levels tend to be pretty decent when I'm in a pretty well fasted state, but they spike a lot higher than most people's eating the same foods. And I have a hard time disposing of it. So for example, I have 2 slices of pizza, I'll spike up to 250 and I'll stay super elevated for many hours. Whereas most people would spike up to, 150 or less, and then they can get returned to baseline in, 45 minutes to an hour. So we knew that this was an issue and something to pay attention to. Pay attention in terms of, Peter put me on a continuous glucose monitor so I can monitor this stuff over time. I could see what my trigger foods were. So I could know to avoid brown rice. I know I could avoid popcorn or refined carbohydrates or things like that. So it's been great. I mean, I've now close to four years of data on Dexcom, and I know what my trigger foods are. It's like pretty straightforward on what I should avoid and what I shouldn't eat. And I try to keep my glucose levels within healthy ranges. So obviously I don't want diabetes. And then also, there's a bunch of energy related things with the roller coaster of glucose. And also the elevated glucose levels are linked to all kinds of bad things, different types of cancers and whatnot. So glucose is a big deal. It's important for all of us to at least peer into that window and, get your fasting glucose levels checked from your primary care physician from time to time, just to see where you're at and see if you have any issues. I highly recommend talking to your doctor about potentially doing a glucose tolerance test to see if you have any of these issues as well. So all of that said, that is kind of the preamble for the podcast. When I was at True, I'd heard about this company and they were, 7 years in development, coming out with a product that was a probiotic that had been double blind, placebo controlled, clinically validated to reduce glucose levels, both in terms of the peaks, the spikes, help you return to baseline more quickly. And it was, you know, sounding interesting. It's not a drug. It's something, it's a strain of bacteria that you could take. Of course, you know, I'm very skeptical. I've taken a ton of different probiotics out there. Why would this one be any different? You know, I just didn't really think much of it. They were in beta doing some beta tests. I took it one time. We got a bottle of it that I tried out and I had purchased as part of their beta program. I tried it for like a week and then I just like, you know, kind of forgot about it and just didn't do anything. So the published study came out showing that it was as good as, you know, metformin, a lot of these other diabetic drugs. And I was like, gosh, I should really give this an all-in try, meaning like for multiple weeks rather than just take it for a few days and expect something to happen. Let's let it take root and take hold into my system and see if anything changes. So this was about now, I'd say 8 weeks ago. So I started taking this probiotic and I was going to give it basically 3 months to see what would happen. And about 4 weeks in, Jess, oh, I hope she doesn't mind me giving her a shout out on here. She's one of Peter Attia's colleagues and works with, monitors all my Dexcom numbers and whatnot. She reached out to me and was like, your numbers are looking a lot better. Like what's going on here? Like things are really improving. And it was a few weeks into taking this probiotic and I started noticing the same thing, meaning that, you know, we're in quarantine. I tend to cheat a little bit more. I got that quarantine 10 pounds. I've since lost it, thankfully, but I got, you know, I put on a little bit of weight during quarantine and I was eating things that I shouldn't and, you know, having a little bit of chocolate here, dark chocolate, having some pizza every once now and then. And I think the biggest offender for me was there's these great, you know, Portland microbreweries and I would have like a beer or two and that would just always shoot up my glucose. And so I noticed like, you know, I could have a beer or two and my glucose really wasn't budging much. It was just going up a tiny bit. It's like, huh, that's interesting. Like that is not normal for me at all. And so I started testing things as the weeks went on, things even started to improve more and more. And I was like, this is weird. And so my wife and I had lasagna night, which is, we do that every few weeks. There's this one particular lasagna I love out here in Portland and it's like all handmade and everything, but I know it's going to be something that's going to send my glucose through the roof. And I'm okay with that. Cause you know, you have to live, right? So I get this lasagna, I eat, you know, my standard, like two big slices of it and my glucose barely moves. Now this is kind of freaky where I'm like, okay, something's wrong with my continuous glucose monitor. In fact, that's the thing that Peter said to me. I sent him a screenshot of it. He's like, your CGM's broken, like get recalibrated. And so I go into the bathroom, I check my blood sugar levels. They're low. I, you know, do this for multiple days and I keep trying to throw things at it, like rice and popcorn and things that were just always really, just horrible for me. It had fixed all of these things and I was blown away. And I seriously was like, I couldn't believe it. I thought something was wrong. I'm like, okay, let me see. I got a new sensor for my Dexcom. I checked that. I've been doing my, I've even thought I had to go buy a new pack of glucose test strips because I thought, well, maybe this one's like expired or something's weird. Like they got like, I don't know. I was just making up things of why this could potentially be like, was this really working? So the short answer is that it is working and it's unbelievable and it has really helped my glucose levels. And so I wanted to have the CEO on to talk about this and talk about what this product is, why it is so different than all the other probiotics that are out there, why they had to develop their own lab because they couldn't get any other commercial labs to grow them because they didn't have the technology to do so. So they spent 7 years working on this. It's a fascinating story. We also talk about the applications to IBS related issues and potentially depression. Colleen is just brilliant, brilliant scientists and a great group of people doing fantastic work. So I am thrilled to bring this story to the masses and tell you all about it because I feel very fortunate that it wasn't my deal that we did at True Ventures, but one of my colleagues did and invested in this company in the very early stages because it is just so cool to see this working. And I feel that the applications for this and the potential for this to really reverse diabetes in many people or help people that are pre-diabetic is just, it's enormous. And it could be a very massive, huge company in the coming years. And I wanted to let you know about it early on, because if this is something that you know, you're having issues with, or you know someone that is having issues with, or you do get your blood work checked and you are having elevated inflammation or gut related issues, it's definitely worth talking to your physician about. Anyway, so this is the interview with CEO of Pendulum, Colin Cutcliffe. Fantastic story. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for taking the time to chat. I would love to start off and just hear your background and story, how life brought you to this company.
As everybody's story is, it's pretty much never really planned. So I got my PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology from Johns Hopkins, and then did a pretty traditional path from there. I did a postdoc at Northwestern, and then I moved out to California and worked in a pharmaceutical company as a scientist, and then kind of moved up into management, and then worked for a startup company that went through an IPO while I was there. And so I think that's sort of where I got my first taste of what it means to create something and then to really bring it out to the masses. And I think once you get a taste of startup life, it's kind of hard to go back. One of the things that I started to learn about while I was at that company was the microbiome.
What year was this?
This was in, 2011, 2012.
Okay.
And the company I was at was a DNA sequencing instrument company called Pacific Biosciences. And so sort of as Illumina was on the rise and Pacific Biosciences was creating a different kind of technology and sequencing, but DNA sequencing was definitely kind of starting to really become more well adopted and used. And so as I was starting to learn about the microbiome arena, I realized that there was sort of an opportunity to take a lot of my scientific background, pharmaceutical development background, and now DNA sequencing knowledge and apply it into the space to find products and applications for this kind of new science that was on the rise. And so that was really a starting point for getting interested in the microbiome space. And then I had two people that I was working with at Pacific Biosciences. We weren't on the same team, but one of us is a biostatistician. The other one was a physicist. I'm a biochemist. And the three of us were really interested in the application of DNA sequencing, in particular, the technology that we had built at Pacific Biosciences in the microbiome space to get really high resolution data that enables you to find novel targets to go after.
What about that particular technology made you think like there's more to uncover here? Did you just know there's so many unclassified bacteria and you wanted to kind of dig into that?
Well, I think there were three really key things. So the first is what you're pointing to, which is there are, you know, tens of thousands of different bacterial strains out there. And so it seemed like there was this big opportunity that had been untapped. And the second is when I looked at all the products that were on the shelves, I started to realize that they were the same 15 to 20 ingredients, just combined in slightly different ways, slightly different CFUs from each other, but that these 15 to 20 ingredients had all been grandfathered into being considered safe by the FDA like 40 or 50 years ago. That means there has been no ingredient and strain innovation for decades. And so then that seemed like, okay, well, there's this is ripe for innovation here from a scientific standpoint. There's been great marketing innovation. And I think that's why the probiotics and supplement spaces have continued to grow, but there hasn't been any new ingredients.
How does that work? Like if you discover a bacteria and you're like, I believe this to be beneficial, I want to bring it to market. So you're telling me that there was only an approved list. And so if you have something new and novel that you found, but it already exists in humans, like it's not like you're introducing it from some other place or modifying it. What's the process like? Can you, if it already exists in humans, can you just grow it and distribute it? Or do you have to go through some type of approval process?
Yeah, you have to go through an approval process to get it recognized as safe. And so really the fact that there had been no innovation is pointing to the fact that no one had looked for any new strains. There's kind of manufacturers who've been around for decades, and most people don't grow their own strains. They purchase it from a third-party manufacturer, mix it into a bottle, slap their marketing label onto it, and that's the new product that they're making. Mm-hmm. So there really hadn't been discovery of new strains that people wanted to then manufacture and commercialize. So it was like there was all these strains that hadn't been, that aren't on the marketplace. There hadn't been innovation in a long time. And then the third thing was when you looked at the strains that were starting to come out of academia as being really interesting and potentially playing a role in health and disease, not a single one of them was one of these ones that was on the shelf. So there's a real opportunity to identify new things that actually target a disease that you could get designated as safe and bring to market.
Very cool. And so that sounds like a great idea on paper, but how do you go about like identifying these strains and finding them?
Well, actually, that part was the part that we felt we knew how to do. So coming from a pretty strong scientific background and being equipped with the tools of DNA sequencing, we felt like we could, like I said, get this really high resolution data that would enable us to find targets. And just to give you a sense, at that time, there were a few other microbiome companies that came out that were trying to do diagnostics, and you could get at that time a microbiome, you know, diagnostic test done for about $100. And those people were spending probably on the order of $10 to $15 per sample. We were spending thousands of dollars per sample to get these high resolution DNA sequencing and insights into them. So we were really digging deep into what was in each of those samples because we were looking for targets.
So when you say the sequencing of the DNA, what are you doing exactly? Like, what does that process look like?
Well, if you're looking in the gut microbiome, the sample that you're sequencing is actually a stool sample. And I'll tell you a funny story. We did a collaboration with Eric Schatt over at Mount Sinai, and he said, great, I'm going to send you a bunch of microbiome samples over and would love for you guys to sequence and analyze them. And so one day, we were in an incubator at that time with a bunch of other companies. So one day, a box arrives, this big brown box, and I open it up, and inside are 20 buckets of stool.
Wow.
And I was like, I just basically closed the box back up and put it to the side and was like, I can't deal with that right now.
Yeah, seriously.
They're stool samples and you're extracting DNA from them. That's really where all of your microbes are. And it's a proxy. It's not the same thing that's happening in your colon, but you can start to see what's happening in your colon based on what's coming out of it.
And then what about this, like the source of this stool? Like, are you looking for healthy individuals? Are you looking for certain people that that are sick and what they're lacking?
Well, at that time, we were looking at both and really trying to compare healthy people to sick people. And then also over time, you know, things change in your microbiome. So trying to understand what happens over time to a particular person. But really, at that time, we were looking at healthy, trying to look for trends among healthy people, and then looking at different diseases. We didn't know we were going to go after diabetes at that time. We were actually just looking at a wide variety of different diseases, ranging from metabolic syndrome, you know, diabetes and prediabetes and obesity, to things like chronic fatigue syndrome, IBS. We were really looking at a wide variety of things and saying, all right, where can we find a signal that we believe in and strains that we could go out and manufacture and test?
So when you say you're looking at these diseases, are you then finding individuals that have that disease and then looking at their biome?
Yes. Yeah, so at that time, we did it primarily as collaborations with clinics that had access to patients that had been clinically validated as having these diseases and then also had the ability to collect those stool samples and ship them to us. You have to basically freeze that sample right away and keep it at minus 80 while you're shipping until you're ready to process it. So it did require partnership with clinics.
And when you dive into the microbiome of, say, someone that has type 2 diabetes, is there something that just jumps out at you as being like, you get this super high resolution picture of what's going on? Is there an overgrowth of certain bacteria? Is there an underrepresentation of certain bacteria? Like, what are you seeing when you look underneath the covers?
Well, there was sort of a really fortuitous thing that happened to us at that time. So we saw that people with diabetes were low or entirely missing a certain category of microbes. And these are microbes that metabolize fibrin to butyrate and microbes that help regulate the gut lining. So we were observing that people with diabetes were low or missing these. And there seemed to be a clear mechanism of action here. We all know a high fiber diet is really good for us, but people who are lower missing these strains are actually unable to metabolize that fiber. And so they're not getting all the benefits out of it. And if you have a misregulated gut lining, you have what's become known as leaky gut. And so you have all these things your microbiome is making, these small molecules, and now they're getting across your gut lining and into your bloodstream. And that causes heightened inflammation and immune responses and all that. So we identified these and we said, okay, there's a clear mechanism here by which these things could be leading to susceptibility to diabetes. But then two other things happened. There was a big study that came out of China at that time where they were also looking at healthy versus people with type 2 diabetes, and they made their data available. And we looked into that data and we actually saw the same trends in their data. And then the other thing that happened was that there was a study that came out of Europe where they did what's called a fecal microbiome transplant. Mm-hmm. And that is where it's exactly what it sounds like. You take stool from one person and you put it into another person. And they did this transplant and they saw that they were able to see a resolution of type 2 diabetes symptoms when they took a healthy person's stool and put it into a person with type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
So from that, we were like, all right, we identified these things. We're seeing another group that's identified similar things, although they hadn't pulled it out. It was in their raw data. We were able to see that. And then we're seeing that there's proof that the microbiome might actually have some curative properties in it. Let's go build this.
Wow. And how do you go build something like this to do this at scale and to grow these out? It must be just insane.
Well, I would say when we said, let's go build this out, we didn't know exactly what that meant. And so, I liken starting a company to having kids. One day you're like, let's do it. Let's have a kid. And the less you know about what you're about to do, the more excited you are about what you're about to do. So we were kind of in that position. And our original plan was, look, there are all these probiotics that are already on the shelves and there's manufacturers of them. We're just going to contact some of those guys and we're going to send them these strains. We've isolated them. We're going to send them over to them and they're going to manufacture it. So we thought we would hire one microbiologist in the company who would basically, keep it real for us and manage these different contract manufacturers. And that would be it. But what we found was that every contract manufacturer that we sent our strains to sent us back dead stuff. And when you dig into why that is, there's a fundamental difference between the things that are on the shelves today and what I believe are going to be the things that pop up in the next 5 to 10 years. And it's this. It's about anaerobic strains. So your gut actually doesn't really have any oxygen in it. So these strains that are really effective and are living in your gut, many of them are what's called strict anaerobes. And that means when you're manufacturing them, you cannot have a single molecule of oxygen enter the manufacturing. Otherwise, the whole batch dies. And that's not what the case is for all the probiotics that are on the shelves now. They're not these strict anaerobes. You can have some oxygen come in. You can be a little bit more loosey-goosey. And so all the equipment and all the processes that have been set up by these big contract manufacturers did not keep oxygen entirely out. And that's why they were sending us back dead strains. Mm. And so through that, we ended up realizing, all right, well, if we really want to test these things, we're going to have to figure out how to grow them. And we hired a team of amazing microbiologists that were all fresh out of, postdocs and PhDs to come and grow these things. And it really was, a pretty pure science experiment at that time, hacking together systems. And we have pictures of people in the lab, it was like MacGyvering all these different things together to try to get these strains to grow. And the first growth that we did was 50 microliters. And so that was like a success. We had like a big party when we were able to grow 50 microliters of these strains.
Give people a sense of what that is volume wise. Like how big is that?
Yeah. That's like, think about a test tube, like let me think about what that would be. It's basically, 4 drops of liquid.
Wow.
If you had an eyedropper, it'd be 4 drops. And that was like a huge success that we could even get those to grow. And so from there, we then scaled up. And it really was this group of microbiologists that figured this out. And there was no blueprint. People had not done this before. We were collaborating pretty heavily with certain academics who were also interested in growing these strains and just had to figure out how to grow them and scale them up ourselves so that we could test them.
Now, when you grow them up and scale them, at what point can, because obviously you're shipping pills that are exposed to oxygen, at what point can they survive in an oxygen environment?
It's pretty late in the process. So when you think about like beer brewing, it's very actually similar to that, where you have this strain, which is like you start with a single colony, and then you grow it up in these vats and you move them to larger and larger vats over time. And then you've got this big kind of liquid culture that has all of these bacteria in it. You then have to spin them down. So you have to separate the liquid from the cells themselves. And then we go through a freeze drying process called lyophilization. And so you literally are freezing them, evaporating all the water out. And then, you get this cake. We actually have a bunch of equipment that are that's cooking equipment in our lab. So you literally lay them out in these cake sheets and you put them into this freezer and you're evaporating all the water. And then after it's freeze dried, it's now you can use a blender to kind of get it into a powder form, and then it's stable. Then it's stable at room temperature or stable at exposed to oxygen.
Crazy. So you had to do all of this before you could even test it in humans, right? Like you had to get this process down because you had to make enough for at least a few people to start trying this out, right?
Yeah, well, actually, the first thing you have to do is to try it out in order to get that safety thing to put it into people. You have to do a bunch of lab experiments to show that the thing does what you think it's going to do. You have to test it for antibiotic resistance. You have to test it for virulence factors. You have to DNA sequence the thing to show that it doesn't have any propensity for infection. Then you have to test it in animals to show that it's safe in animals. If it kills a mouse, you definitely are not going to be allowed to put it into a human. And then you finally get to put it into a person.
It's crazy because this already, like these strains already existed in humans though, right? It's just, I guess it would be you would be introducing a lot more of something.
You would be introducing it to people who didn't have it. And so you don't know why they lost it. We have some hypotheses.
So they don't have it at all, or they just have very, very small bits of it. Is it just they're completely null and void of any of this?
Some people are low. Some people are literally entirely missing them.
Wow. Is it antibiotics? What are you thinking? Why are people lacking this?
Well, some of the data that's come out that shows the things that alter your microbiome. So first of all, the microbiome, I'll just make this point, is really different from your own DNA, because whatever you have genetically, that's what you've got and you can't really do much about it. But the microbiome is an amazing opportunity because you can change it, and you do change it all the time. And so what we found is that, and we meaning the scientific community, is that there are all sorts of things that alter the microbiome. Antibiotics are definitely one of the most potent ways to disrupt your microbiome. But every time you travel, you're disrupting your microbiome. Every time you change your diet, you go from one type, let's say you go from being an omnivore to being a vegetarian, you're changing your microbiome. Every time you change the time zone you're in, your circadian rhythm changes, your microbiome changes. As you age, your microbiome changes. As you go from being a kid to an adult, when you go through puberty, your microbiome changes. As you undergo stress, your microbiome changes. So there are all these things that are happening to us that are altering our microbiome, some of which we know we're doing deliberately, some of which we don't really have control over. And the beauty is that you can change it back.
Yeah, that's so cool. So first you had to go out and find people that were lacking it, right? So were you doing stool samples initially to see, okay, do you have this or not?
Well, we were a little bit nervous to first put it into people that were missing or sick. And so we first put it into healthy people. And I always say, don't trust a chef who won't eat their own cooking. Among the first group of people that tried it were us three founders. And so we were providing stool samples. We were taking the product. We were going to higher and higher doses to see what would happen to our stool samples. It was all under a physician. So our chief medical officer actually ran it. We were giving blood to make sure that we weren't having any weird health things, alter. These are things that do exist in people. And we all had these strains, many of these strains in our systems to begin with, but you just never know when you're administering something new in a different way, if it's going to have some adverse event. And so we've really developed this as you would a pharmaceutical drug and been really careful to start with healthy people. And then moved into people with pre-diabetes, like did a very small pilot study there, and then did a study in people with type 2 diabetes.
How do you define pre-diabetes? Like what is the threshold for that?
Yeah, this is a great topic of conversation because it's sort of a little bit of a moving target. The metabolic syndrome is classified by two kind of key numbers. One is your HbA1c levels, and then the other is your kind of fasting blood glucose or your glucose response to foods. And if you have a high HbA1c, and if you have a high fasting glucose, or you get a really big spike after you eat foods, you have metabolic syndrome. So if you're healthy, you have an A1C number and you have a glucose number and you get a glucose spike after you eat, But it's under this particular range. And then as it gets worse and worse, you get classified as pre-diabetes, and then ultimately as type 2 diabetes. But actually the cutoffs for those numbers, it has moved from time to time. So it's really about your A1C testing numbers and your glucose numbers.
And for people that don't know, would you consider an A1C to be kind of like a rolling 3-month average of your glucose? Is that accurate?
Yes, exactly right. So if we want to get into the technical part here, HbA1c is a hemoglobin cell. And what happens is if you have sugar that sits in your bloodstream for too long, eventually what your body does is it basically just attaches those sugars to your red blood cells, sort of a way of scooping them up. And so everybody has a certain percentage of their red blood cells that have glucose attached to it. But the more glucose that you have free in your system, the more your body is going to attach these to your red blood cells. So your red blood cells turn over about every 3 months. And that's why it's when you're measuring your HbA1c, it's kind of a rolling number, as you say, over a 3-month period, because that's how long it takes for those red blood cells to turn over. So if you're running a study on yourself or in a trial, what you really want to look at is your starting A1C number, and then you want to look at it 3 months later, because now you'll know, okay, at that point, all my red blood cells have turned over. Did I really move the needle on my A1C?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing for me, and I first started paying attention to my glucose levels about, I'd say, 4 or so years ago. Peter Attia, my primary physician, he had me come in and do a glucose tolerance test where I drink like a straight up, like 100% sugar drink. And then, you know, he was measuring my insulin and glucose response over, I believe, 3 hours, 2 or 3 hours. And we saw that not only was there a much bigger spike in elevation of glucose, but I was really bad at doing glucose disposal. So I would stay elevated for longer periods of time. That said, when I would get back down to normal ranges, my fasting glucose was quite good. My A1C was pretty decent, but I did have issues. And I then started doing a continuous glucose monitor, and I would see, you know, things like popcorn and rice and, you know, just even things, really simple things like potatoes unprocessed would just spike me through the roof, like really high, like, you know, 200 plus. And it was just, you know, something that we wanted to pay attention to. So I'll talk about my experience with your product in a little bit, but that was what brought me into the curiosity around this. What would you say are some of the other, because I mean, obviously diabetes is a big deal. It's linked to all types of bad things happening to the body and cancers and a whole slew of things. But I know one of the conversation we'd had, you'd said that when people have fluctuations and like a little bit of a roller coaster in their blood sugar, that also impacts energy levels as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. When you're going through your day and every time you eat something, you get a big sugar high. And to your point, you're not able to get that sugar processed over a long period of time. And then afterwards, everybody experiences a sugar crash. Every human goes through that. So depending on this roller coaster, how big the highs are and how low the crashes are, your body is literally on a roller coaster all day long. And so when you're able to minimize those spikes and minimize those crashes, it shows up for people in a variety of ways. And one of the most clear ones is improved energy. And so on pendulum glucose control, we've had customers report back approximately 70 to 80% of them are experiencing improved energy. And that's before they even see their blood glucose or their A1C numbers change. So your body is really letting you know how it's responding to foods through this energy cycle. And then the other big one is improved sleep. And again, this has to do with, you know, when you eat a late meal or how your body is actually processing these sugars through the night when you're sleeping. If everything's more stabilized, we found that people are also reporting improved sleep.
That's interesting. That's fascinating. It'd be really cool to see you do a study with Oura Ring as well, you know, with so they can monitor the different sleep stages and do pre and post supplementation to see what would happen there in terms of the impact on sleep. That'd be fascinating.
Absolutely. And if there's anybody listening who is willing to wear a continuous glucose monitor and a ring and take the product, we're excited to look at that data and share it back.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely one. I've already done that. So I've got the data. I can share it back. I'm curious, like jumping back to the timeline and to your story. So founders, you know, you cheers the little pills, you take them for the first time, you don't know what's going to happen. You're doing blood draws, you're doing fecal analysis. Like, what are you seeing? First of all, were all of you considered, you know, quote unquote, healthy individuals going into this? Or
yes, we were all, and actually clinically, we had to take a bunch of blood tests and get all of, you know, all the stuff you get done when you go to your general checkup. We had to go through all that to be designated as healthy.
Okay. So none of you had any crazy inflammation markers or anything I guess this is kind of like, okay, you take it. What are you going to see? Did you see any or notice any benefits in the blood work? Was there anything tangible that you could point to outside of just like, you know, I feel like I have more energy?
No, there were no changes for it. Now, we didn't wear continuous glucose monitors at that time. I think if we had, we would have seen something. But with all the standard kind of classic clinical tests, we did not really see anything. The only thing we saw in the stool samples also was really the appearance of the strains. We didn't see any global changes to the microbiome. And I think this is a really important point. I know that there are diagnostic companies out there right now, and many people use them to know, hey, if I take this probiotic, is it doing anything to my microbiome? And I think it's really important to note that you don't actually want the probiotic that you're taking to have some massive global shift in your microbiome. You want a targeted approach that's going to change a specific pathway that's going to benefit you. If something is changing your whole microbiome whole hog, it's kind of like an antibiotic. That's not actually what you're looking for in a targeted approach. Hmm. And so we didn't see any whole hog changes. And even, you know, in all the studies that we've done, for us, it really is sort of a relief to not see these global changes, but instead to say, okay, did the strains that I put in appear? And did the things that are associated with those strains also change? And so you're really targeting a particular pathway and looking for it to be altered.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's not like you put these strains in and all of a sudden, you know, you promoted the growth of a bunch of other strains that you hadn't thought about, or, you know, it was like everything else remained constant and then just these strains increased. Is that correct?
That's right. Yep.
That's really cool. And so no changes, everything looks good. What was the next step?
So the next step was, all right, let's put this into a few people with prediabetes. You know, again, not going straight all the way into people with full-on diabetes, but kind of marching towards that. And then, and I'll say as a sidebar, I then started giving them to my daughter, who at the time was about 9 or 10, because I had originally been interested in this for her, and also making sure that kids could tolerate it. So that's the downside to, I guess, being the kid of somebody who's inventing things. You have to be one of the first testers.
So did she have any issues related to glucose, or?
I didn't go into this, but not only when we started the company, not only was there a microbiome and DNA sequencing opportunity and a probiotic market opportunity, for me personally, as I started to understand more about it, I realized that I had a personal connection here. And it was that my daughter was born almost 8 weeks prematurely. And when you have a baby that's born that early, you deliver the baby, you get to hold it for a couple of seconds, and then they get taken away to the ICN where they actually administer multiple doses of antibiotics. So for the first 4 weeks of her life, she was living in the ICN, getting these different antibiotic treatments, which were prophylactic. She didn't actually have an infection, but they're so fragile, they want to make sure they don't get one. And as she grew older into elementary school, I realized that she was different from the rest of our family. She has some pretty serious food sensitivities, and she has to watch what she eats. She has some metabolic differences compared to the rest of the family, and including her sister. And so she doesn't have prediabetes or diabetes. I haven't put a continuous glucose monitor on her yet, but I know that she has some of these metabolism issues that she deals with. And so that's why I wanted her to take the pills.
Gotcha. So, jumping back into the timeline. So you administer this to people that have some prediabetes. Do they have diabetes as well? Or how big did the sample size grow to at that point?
So this was still super small. It was like less than 5 people. And we had them wear continuous glucose monitors, and we actually did a double-blinded randomized placebo-controlled trial. So that means that they were either on a placebo pill or on the product. and they wore a continuous glucose monitor through this whole trial. And then they had a washout and then they switched to the other thing. So you could really compare in a particular person, how does their body respond to a placebo pill versus the actual pill? And of course, that person is blinded. They don't know what they're getting. And it was very cool because, Kevin, basically we saw for every individual when they were on the pill compared to placebo, they experienced a dramatic decrease in their blood sugar spikes. And this study was pretty short. They were only on the pills for a few weeks.
Was it 4 weeks or six or?
Well, actually, it was 2 weeks on placebo or 2 weeks on pills. And the reason for that is because you can wear a continuous glucose monitor for 14 days. And so we wanted to get one monitor's worth of data for the whole time.
Wow, that's crazy because, you know, I feel that in me personally, it wasn't until like week 3 to 4 where I really started seeing my numbers correct and everything change.
Well, we were running these, the glucose tolerance test that you alluded to. So where the person had a big dose of sugar and we were measuring that. So you couldn't see it as clearly on, if you looked across all the data, kind of what you did. But if you did this glucose tolerance test, that's what we were measuring. And we were measuring that change. But one of the other cool things we saw was that, we were allowing people to take photographs of their food and document that and then trying to line it up with their glucose response. And so they had kind of this log of food. And one of the things we observed was that most people tend to eat pretty similar breakfast or the same breakfast multiple times a week. And so if you actually tracked their breakfast where they had the same breakfast over time, you could also see this effect.
Mm.
We tend to be a little bit more disparate when it comes to lunch and dinner, but I guess we like our breakfast a certain way.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing about breakfast is it's always been a bummer to me that I have never been able to enjoy like steel cut oats. Like, you know, so many people, you always hear about the benefits of, you know, unprocessed, like whole grains and, you know, things like steel cut oats and even like brown rice, those have always been just massive spikes for me on the glucose monitor. So I'm really excited to go back in and try that. And it's funny. I mean, even last night, I had Mike Mazur over, who's the CEO of Zero. He's been in quarantine as well. So we had finally got to see some people for the first time come over to the house and we all had the same Thai food. He was wearing his continuous glucose monitor. I was wearing mine and we always were like, just CGM buddies. Like we always share our data, like, oh, I had this, look at what happened here. You know, we're always like texting each other screenshots of our data. It's super geeky and dumb, but we do it. It's kind of fun. And it was cool because we were sitting next to each other and we were having the exact same meal and we were just eating the same portions and everything. And I've always been like, my spikes have always been probably 2 to 3x larger than his historically. And he's always been like, oh man, I've never seen spikes that high. And, you know, always making me feel bad about myself. And so we ate the same meal and he just started your probiotic here just a couple days ago. So he didn't have enough time for it to kick in. And I was lower than he was after eating the sticky rice and the Thai food. And I was just like, he was just blown away. And it is so cool and such an amazing feeling to see that in real data right there, side by side, same meal, same portion size. You know, it's crazy. So it must have felt really good to start to see some of these results come out of people and see that it actually was working.
Absolutely, Kevin. And your story and other people's stories, and people share continuous glucose monitor data with us and share stories of, you know, this improved sleep, improved energy, better lifestyles. I was just talking to somebody yesterday who grew up in a house of diabetes, watched all of the terrible things that can happen, and then was devastated when they themselves got diagnosed with it, and now has this beautiful success story of having, you know, moved out of actually having diabetes into not having it because they were able to move their A1C and glucose numbers down. I've talked to people who have reduced their insulin doses, reduced their metformin doses while they've been on the product. These stories are the reason we started the company, and it's just super rewarding to create something that works. It's just really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you don't really see something like this come along that often. Like, you know what I mean? Like that really, truly, you hear about. I mean, I've as a, you know, quote unquote biohacker, I've tried every supplement under the sun for a whole variety of different things, just out of curiosity, mainly, you know, for cognitive health or for stomach related stuff or you name it. I've probably tried it. And it's very rare that you can try something and see an impact like this, especially something that is, you know, has such a great safety profile. Like it's really quite amazing to watch the numbers correct themselves and just be able to throw things at it that were, you know, like lasagna night or like things that I would just never entertain doing. Just out of curiosity, be like, let me see if I can break this probiotic. And it just doesn't, it just works. So I'm curious, like, so what did you find out? What was happening? Like, how did you figure out the role of butyrate and how did you get to the, you know, underlying principles that you were targeting that you figured out how to repair?
I think what you're pointing to is actually points to one of the things that we've observed, which is a fundamental problem with our health system in developing new products. You have pharmaceutical companies which develop products in a very similar way to what we did. We were using some pretty standard, ingrained scientific approaches here. And those companies develop pharmaceutical drugs, which then go on to be very high priced because the cost of developing those drugs is very high. As I said, you know, we were spending thousands of dollars per sample to sequence them. And then the clinical trials are, you know, run upwards of tens of millions of dollars into hundreds of millions of dollars. It's an expensive thing to develop a drug that works. On the other hand, for these consumer products, because they know at the end of the day, they have to sell it to a consumer that's going to be willing to pay for it out of pocket. If you are going to know that you have to sell something for $20 a month at the end of the day, it does not make sense to go invest in all of this discovery and science and manufacturing and clinical trials, because you'll never be able to create a product that's monetizable at the end of the day. And so you have this skewed system where all this great science and clinical work is being done on the pharmaceutical side. And then the things that consumers can actually get themselves is just not a very high quality of science going into it and no innovation going into it, because it doesn't make sense from a business standpoint. And so I think that the world is shifting away from people needing their doctors and pharmaceutical companies to tell them what's going to help them, and shifting towards people understanding that I could get access to products directly that could help me, and I can learn about my own health through all the information that's available to me. And we really believe that if you pair that desire for people to actually take on preventative medicine themselves and to measure themselves and to proactively try to tackle their diseases on their own, and you offer them something that you've developed with real scientific and clinical rigor, that you will break that paradigm shift. And so, you know, the product that we've created does take a lot of money and time to develop. We're 7 years into this. This is not an overnight project. But at the end, we're creating what I think is the beginning of a new category of products that have actual clinical data behind them, that you'll see real results like what you're seeing, but you can get it yourself. You don't have to go through a doctor and get a prescription for it.
That's so awesome. Like, I just really feel like I'd be curious to get your take on what other applications, and then I want to dive into butyrate and figure out what's going on here. But what other applications, like, we've heard so much about the microbiome, you know, over the years about the connection between the brain, and are there a whole slew of things that are potential targets for you? Like, is depression a target? Is Alzheimer's disease a target? Like, what are the things that you hope to tackle long-term?
Well, I think, you know, beyond metabolism, some of the other things that are in a line of sight include things related to your immune system and things related to inflammation. A lot of things that are classified as chronic diseases, I think, are things that fall into the category of being potential microbiome solutions. And so what are the different chronic diseases? You know, there's, you know, heightened sort of allergies that has to do with your immune response being heightened. There's autoimmune diseases. Depression and anxiety are another one. We think about actually autism. So that's another one where I think that there's an opportunity there from the microbiome standpoint. And so I think the great thing would be to be able to get into people who are younger and younger age to prevent them from having these chronic illnesses. But I think that for right now, we're going after metabolism and immune function. And then we're really, the gut-brain thing is super interesting. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there. So stay tuned.
Yeah, that is super exciting. What's your take? Do you have a position on why people with type 2 diabetes are more susceptible to something like COVID?
It's a very interesting phenomenon that people with type 2 diabetes, as opposed to some of these other diseases, are more susceptible to these complications from COVID. And it is, you know, reasonably well known that there's a correlation between people with diabetes and having heightened inflammation and lower immune response and immune function. So I think, you know, that's an important part of the story. And for us, we are actually really interested in knowing whether our product can help people on that front, because part of the pathway of butyrate is to stimulate your T regulator cells. And so you have all these T regulator cells that are in your bloodstream, and their job is to basically, you know, man the fence. So whenever there's something fishy that comes along, they know to respond. And so what ends up happening in a lot of people with diabetes is that they have misregulation or underrepresentation of these T regulator cells. And so they basically have less of a defense system kind of perpetually. And so one of the things that butyrate has been shown to do is to actually stimulate that T regulator response and to increase the number of these cells that are circulating in your body, and therefore get you a heightened immune response or heightened immune, you know, defense system in general. And so we're really curious to look at those markers in people with diabetes, and particularly comparing people who get sick pretty frequently to people who don't. And I think we know that there are all these things related to your immune system. And in fact, depression is another really interesting one. The more depressed you are, the more susceptible you are to being ill. And so the immune system, I think, is a really interesting thing to target. And the microbiome has some really clear straight lines between microbes and your immune system and how those two things communicate with each other.
Let's just say someone out there is a really geeky kind of biohacker type person. Maybe I'm actually just speaking for myself. Who wants to go deep on the blood work and see what's going on? When you think about, one, can you check for T regulator cells? Is that a panel that you can get done? And then two, what are the other inflammation markers that you look at in the data? Like, are there a slew of different things that you're checking for?
There are a lot of different panels for measuring inflammatory and immune response. Some of the more common ones are C-reactive protein. That's one of the common ones used to measure the inflammatory response. But then there are these big panels of interleukins, the IL-8.
Yeah, IL-6.
Right, exactly. And then panels of cytokines. And so I think it's really interesting, if you are really curious about that data, to get those panels done, you know, take the product and then see how those change over time. And you can go into Quest or LabCorp, as long as you get your doctor to write it up for you, you can go get them done anywhere. So they're pretty common.
Yeah, I've had all those done, so I'm really excited to see, and I'll report back once I go get a new panel here shortly on how those change. Have you had any, or do you have any experience with anything related to homocysteine at all?
We haven't really been looking into homocysteine as a marker that we've been tracking, but definitely one of the interesting things that our team has started to do is to get plasma, you know, blood samples, and actually look at all the different metabolites in your blood samples, which includes you know, amino acids, and starting to see actually that the that pendulum glucose control is changing some of those metabolites. And there's some of them that are particularly interesting because they relate to potentially inflammation and the immune response. And so we're really early in that R&D work, but we might be impacting through butyrate a variety of different systems.
Let's jump into butyrate. I think it's a great time to talk about. So what we've covered so far is you've identified, now how many different strains? Is it five that are in this supplement that you're putting out?
Yes, it has five strains plus the prebiotic that feeds those strains.
Okay, so can you break down why you chose each of those five?
Yes, so the metabolism of fiber into butyrate is actually a multi-step biochemical reaction. And so we've included strains that can do each of those steps, so that in the single pill, you have the entire ability to break down fiber all the way to butyrate. And then we also have specific strain which has been shown to be involved in the mucin layer of your gut lining, and that's got to do with, you know, that regulation of the gut lining.
And then explain to folks what butyrate actually is. So on, and both the when you don't have it, what happens to fiber? And then when you do have these probiotics, what happens to fiber?
So the strains will metabolize fiber into butyrate, and butyrate is actually a quite well-known small molecule. You can buy butyrate supplements and have been able to for quite some time. And there have been a lot of, pretty really good animal studies showing that butyrate can impact a variety of different diseases, including actually diabetes. Butyrate's a small molecule. It's sort of pretty interesting. In your colon, your colonic cells are the only cells in your body that instead of using glucose as their primary source of energy, they use butyrate as their primary source of energy. And so that means that butyrate is kind of a pretty key part of your entire colon and colon health. And in fact, for people with colon cancer, butyrate has been a target for quite some time. They're shown to have reduced levels of butyrate, and that probably has something to do with the misregulation of those colon cells. And so having a healthy colon, it's known that you want to have good levels of butyrate. And so, and then the healthy colon, of course, plays a role in a wide variety of things, including how your food is metabolized, how it's kept inside the colon, and all the things that we've been talking about here today around diabetes and inflammation and immune response.
So when you say how your food is metabolized, like let's just say I consume some sticky rice, which I did last night. It was fantastic. What happens at that point when it hits your gut, and what is changed when it's starting to be processed? So I understand what happens when, it's broken down, glucose hits, it spikes me. What's changed there exactly?
So what's changed is having these strains that will take that metabolism all the way to butyrate. So there's some strains that can metabolize those foods, and then you have different output and different small molecule outputs. And what we're really trying to do is to drive the whole system to metabolize these fibers to land with butyrate, which is this really beneficial molecule and what you want to increase, as opposed to going down any of those side avenues and ending up with some other small molecule.
So are they eating glucose then? Like what are the strains actually attaching to?
They actually consume fiber. I mean, the fiber is their food, and they consume that fiber, and they spit out essentially butyrate. And then once you have butyrate, what happens is butyrate binds to these G protein coupled receptors, which are in your gut lining. And then those G protein coupled receptors stimulate GLP-1 release, which then stimulates insulin and glucose tolerance. And so the pathway of butyrate binding to G protein coupled receptors to stimulating GLP-1 to stimulating glucose and insulin response, that pathway is all actually really, really well known. And there are multi-billions of dollars worth of products that are targeting that pathway very effectively. The probably most well-known of which is insulin itself, but then also these GLP-1 analogs and all of that. So then upstream of that, fiber is well-known to help people. And of course, there's a multi-billion dollar market around fiber foods and fiber supplements and fiber products. But what's been missing all this time is those gut microbes that actually metabolize that fiber into butyrate. And this is really the missing link of this pathway, of which we knew upstream fiber was really good, and we knew downstream butyrate was really good. And now we know how to give you the tools to metabolize that fiber into butyrate.
That's really cool. So basically you're just enabling the body to do what it knows how to do best, right? Like you're enabling those natural pathways to just take over.
You're enabling those natural pathways to take over. And I would say too that, we all probably remember a time in our lives where we didn't have to worry about what we were eating or exercising or any of that stuff. And likely had lots of these microbes sitting in our guts doing this metabolism for us. But over time, because of things like aging and stress and our lifestyles, you start to lose these. And so you're really giving back something that is enabling your body to do what it once was able to do itself.
Now, why wouldn't someone just take supplemental butyrate?
Well, lots of people do take supplemental butyrate, and there's this really weird disconnect between animal studies and human studies when it comes to butyrate. So you have all these animal studies where butyrate is highly effective. I mean, really amazing results. And then you translate that into humans, and all of a sudden the clinical trials are kind of a flop. And I think it boils down to location, location, location. So because all of your colon cells consume butyrate, and there are a lot of other cells that consume butyrate, the problem with the butyrate supplement itself is that you take it and then you don't really know where it's going to land or who's going to consume it before it gets to these G protein coupled receptors where you really want that butyrate to get to. the beauty of these microbes is that you just need those microbes to get into the colon, then they will self-localize where they're supposed to be. And then when they metabolize the fiber, they're actually right next to these G-protein coupled receptors where they can then deliver the butyrate right to the receptor it's supposed to get to. And so that, to me, is likely the biggest difference between just taking butyrate versus taking the strains, which will naturally land where they're supposed to be. And then that fiber now metabolized into butyrate is sitting where it's supposed to be sitting to have its effect.
Gotcha. So you're basically just going like one more step upstream to create a more natural effect versus just dumping something in your stomach and hoping it gets to the right place.
And hoping it's the right place and knowing that there's a lot of interference that's going to happen. It's like trying to, you know, on a soccer field, stand at one end and kick a goal. You might have great aim and you've got the ball, but there are all these people in between that are going to stop it from getting there versus handing it to the striker who's standing right in front of the goal and saying, now kick it in. So right. It's really about the location.
That's interesting. So on the butyrate side, is there a such thing as too much? Like, could anyone ever get low blood sugar levels because of this, or how does that self-regulate?
You know, it's a great question. And to be totally honest, it's something that we're exploring, but I don't think that I have a solid answer yet that is completely backed by clinical data. We don't fully know. Well, with our probiotic, we have dosed pretty high and we haven't seen any adverse events. But that doesn't mean that for certain people, there might be issues. And so that's definitely something for further study.
Yeah. When you stop taking this probiotic, how long do you see it continue to stand up and work in people until they would need to take it again?
You know, it varies from person to person how long the strains can be sustained in their system. So in the work that we've done, we've seen that after people stop taking the pills and they go for a 4-week washout. At the end of that 4-week period, about 15 to 20% of them actually still have the strains in their system. But the vast majority, 80 to 85%, the strains are gone. We don't fully understand what makes one person able to sustain the strains and another person not able to. And so that's another place of pretty intense studying, because if you could figure out how to take these pills, and then get them to sustain, that would, of course, be better than having to take them for the rest of your life. My suspicion is that some of those individuals have starting microbiomes that were already, and frankly, I think genetics is a component in this too, but they have something about them that already was enabling these strains to grow, and therefore they were able to sustain longer. But there's nothing obvious. We've definitely been digging into it. There's nothing obvious about what makes one person sustain and one person not.
Is there an issue with people avoiding fibers in that you're almost like for me, for example, I was avoiding anything that would spike my glucose. So I'm avoiding a lot of these fibers that could potentially be beneficial and give the right nutrients to this healthy bacteria. Do you see that as being an issue for people that are aware of that?
That is one of the key reasons why you can take a problem and make it worse by not introducing fiber into the system. Because as I said, that's actually what these microbes eat. So if you're not eating fiber, you're definitely not providing the food for them and they will disappear. And interestingly, we've been doing studies with Johns Hopkins around IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. And for a lot of people with IBS, they do the same thing, which is they reduce fiber because it causes upset stomachs for them. But then by reducing fiber, they now are also reducing these microbes. And the really cool studies that we've been doing with Hopkins have shown that if you provide these microbes, you can actually improve the IBS symptoms of pain. And we've actually given this product to several people with IBS and seen pretty dramatic improvements for them without them needing to actually eat more fiber. You know, there's always some fiber in your diet, but this has been dramatically helpful. And I imagine a lot of it's because, you know, you cut out the things that upset your body. And so this is a way to enable people to maybe eat more fiber and not experience all those downsides.
Is there anyone researching, like, say, centenarians, like going out and saying, okay, of people that have, you know, that have a certain longevity, what does their microbiome look like? Have you looked into any of that data?
I think there are quite a few people looking into that for sure. That is not something that we've really tapped into, but I would say that, you know, generally speaking, it is likely that there's a difference in their microbiomes.
Yeah, I wonder how you would tease out other potential strains. Like, for example, on the depression side, like I understand going out and finding a pool of people that are depressed and getting them to donate, that would seem pretty straightforward. But do you look for, on the opposite end of the spectrum, do you look for people that are like subjectively happy, like overly happy, and look at their microbiomes? Like, how do you complete that picture?
Yeah, it would be, I think, pretty great to be able to do that. I think, you know, we've mostly been trying to target diseases and approaching it from that angle. But I agree, you know, if you can move the dial one way, being able to move it the other way is really interesting. And there are definitely groups that look at, for example, high performance athletes and try to understand, you know, what it is about their microbiome that is different from, you know, regular people. And I haven't seen anything really, no products come out that are really tapping into that part. But it is, I agree with you. I think it's interesting.
I'm really curious, as a startup and a founder that is launching something like this. I mean, the clinical trial data looks fantastic. I was excited to have you on because I've seen it personally in myself and I've seen it in my numbers. How do you, is it challenging to convince people that this is real? Like, I feel like, you know, I wouldn't have believed it unless I had actually had the continuous glucose monitor. And I think that so many people are conditioned these days to say, give me metformin, give me a drug. How can a probiotic put, you know, have this big of a impact? It seems like a fairy tale. It doesn't seem real. It just seems like, you know, clever marketing or hype. Like, how do you deal with that as a founder that wants to tell that story? I mean, we're doing it today and telling it through a podcast, but it has to be challenging, doesn't it?
It's definitely challenging. I mean, we are just commercializing this product, you know, this year after the 7 years of hard work. And I think you're right. There's a lot of education around the microbiome and the elevation above the probiotics that are on the shelves, which are for general health, and saying this is actually targeting disease and you will see a difference. I think that it's really important for us to maintain the really strong scientific and clinical credibility that will ultimately get healthcare professionals behind the product. But right now, people who are really interested in proactively addressing disease or proactively managing their sugars, and they are measuring it, are seeing a difference. Like, once people start on our product, we have very, very little drop off. And that's because people are seeing the results. And I say, you know, if a product is able to show you and solve a problem for you that you have, you will stay on it. Now, that's not to say we can get away with no marketing, but I think that, you know, the best marketing is people believing and seeing that it works and then sharing that news out, and then physicians seeing it working and sharing it out, and diabetes educators seeing it working and sharing that out. And so it is hard to sell a new product that is, you know, touting a benefit that people really haven't seen before. But once mm-hmm. you see it, there's really no going back. And I think the other, you know, challenge is the price point. And you have a lot of people out there just sort of putting artificially high price points on probiotics. And here, as I said, the manufacturing is a serious challenge. It costs us a lot to make these strains. They're cold chain the whole way, meaning everything has to stay refrigerated for the whole process. And that's not an easy thing. And it's pretty expensive to make them. So now you're asking people to take a leap of faith on a kind of product they've never seen before at a high price point. So yeah, it's definitely a challenge. But I think if we stay true to making sure that we're helping people see their benefit, so we offer free A1C testing at time zero, and then at 3 months in, we also offer nutrition consultations. We're really trying to help people see the benefits of the product. And if we stay true to that scientific core, I believe that this will spread.
What would you recommend to people? Like, I'm on the product now. Are there things that I can eat that go side by side with the probiotic that's going to make it even more sticky and more effective for me?
Yeah. So because fiber is the food for the products, increasing your fiber consumption is definitely, like, go hit the farmer's market. Those are all going to help. Those are all going to help the strains.
That's fantastic. Last question. You know, my wife, she does not have glucose issues, but she's been completely blown away by my data. She's also a scientist. She's a neuroscientist, but she's been looking at my data and was really impressed. I have other friends that have just heard how excited I am about this, and they actually want to buy it just because they think like, wow, that's producing some amazing results. Why do you take it if you're healthy? And then are there any benefits that a person that doesn't have glucose issues would see in taking something like this?
Yeah, I've been taking it since I was the first guinea pig because I experienced improved energy. And actually, for me, I could see it clearly in my workouts. So, you know, I was able to go stronger, faster, longer. And I hadn't changed anything except for being on the pills. So then, of course, I had to wear a continuous glucose monitor and see what was happening. And what I saw was that all of my spikes and crashes were minimized. And I think that's the explanation for the higher energy. So I'm healthy. I don't have prediabetes or diabetes. I don't have unruly glucose spikes. But I take it because everybody has glucose spikes and everybody has glucose crashes. And so if you can help your body to metabolize sugars better, and you can help your body to not go through that roller coaster ride throughout the day, it is actually better for you in the long run in terms of preventing those kinds of chronic illnesses that are related to misregulation of glucose. And also, I think a lot of people will see it in terms of improved energy, improved digestion, actually, also. We hear the vast majority, I think like 90% of our customers also note that they have better digestion and GI stress. And so I think for all of those reasons, if you're healthy and you want to stay healthy, it makes sense to be on the pills. And, you know, as I've aged, I definitely want to avoid certain chronic illnesses by providing my body with these strains that it's likely losing over time so that I can stay healthy.
Yeah, that's great. I can see that being a big benefit for a lot of folks. I was definitely one of those people that had that afternoon crash. And I always thought like, oh, it's just because I haven't had my coffee or things like that. And I would say that I certainly notice now a more steady state. And it's not like, I don't feel like I'm like over the top energy, but I definitely don't feel that kind of like afternoon. Like I would like to take a little nap right now. That's gone away, which has been awesome.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, for me, actually, one of the most interesting things is I used to be a workout first thing in the morning person. Like if I didn't get it done first thing in the morning, it was not going to happen as the day got started. And over the last maybe like year and a half, my peak time for working out is actually that midday, which used to be when I was experiencing my biggest crash. And so actually, I've changed my workout time based on when I have the energy to do the best workouts. And now it's exactly at that time, which I used to have my biggest lull.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, Colleen, thank you so much for creating this product. I'm a big fan, and I'm very excited to see. Can you give us any hints as to what other future products might look like, or your roadmap might look like?
Well, this product, I would love to see everybody taking it. So, pendulumlife.com. I'm so excited that you tried it and have seen all these benefits. We have some things in the pipeline to try to improve and enhance the efficacy of it, and start to get at, to your point, how do we even help people who are healthy beyond just these pills? The next thing in the pipeline is targeting IBS.
That's very cool. I mean, that's such a big problem for so many people. That's very exciting. Well, where can people find you? I guess you said pendulumlife.com is the place to go, and they don't need a prescription or anything. They can just sign up and start a trial right away.
Yep. You don't need a prescription. You go to pendulumlife.com. If you sign up to the subscription, you get the free A1C testing, you get the nutrition consultations, and actually you also... we have on the website, you can see like additional member perks. And I'll give you an example of one of them is actually CGM. And then if you are somebody who likes to be involved in different tests, we are literally getting ready to run a test from people who are on the subscription to say, if you added certain fibers, what kind of improvements do you see? And we'll provide the CGMs, and we will do all the data analysis and share it back with people and let you know as an individual what different types of fibers are actually improving the efficacy of the product for your glucose spike. So there's some cool experimentation stuff too, if you do that avenue and are interested in participating in that.
I love that. That's so cool. Like that that's, it reminds me of like Tesla has this mode where you can go in and turn on the experimental features. It's like a little checkbox and you get opted into a bunch of crazy new stuff. Like, sign me up for that. That sounds awesome.
Great. Well, I will sign you up for that, actually.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show. And I hope to have you back at some point and talk about improvements and other launches in the future.
Thank you so much for having me and for giving the product a chance.
All right. That is it for this episode. Again, I wanted to reiterate, I have absolutely no financial ties to this company. I know it's hard because you listen to it and you're like, okay, he's definitely a fanboy. And I am, because it worked for me. And I really hope that by spreading this message, some of you that have these issues will give it a shot. And I hope to hear your stories coming in soon about how it is hopefully also worked for you. So very exciting times. Thanks for listening and take care.